A little over 5 years ago, when I was still teaching middle school chorus in Fond du Lac, I was preparing the kids for a concert on friends and friendship, and I asked them two questions. What makes you happy and what makes you sad? And in all three of the classes, the number one answer, what makes you happy, their response was friends. And not surprising, because it is middle school, the number one answer for what makes you unhappy or makes you sad was friends. So I had prepared the song that we're going to sing for you, It Shouldn't Bother Me. It was about 1 year after a seventh grader at our school had died of suicide and was found shortly afterwards that she was the victim of relentless cyberbullying. So the song was written partially in response to that, and because the spring concert was coming up was this child's one anniversary of her death. So it was weighing on the kids' minds. So we'd like to present to you today the song, It Shouldn't Bother Me. Thank you.
Standing in the hall and talking. in the epistle from James that we just heard, he talks about the potential curses that can come from our tongues, the destruction that can happen as a result. Marge Piercy makes the same point in a poem she writes, and also lifts up the good that can come out of our tongues as well. We are given the wind within us, she writes, the breath to shape into words that steal time, that touch like hands and pierce like bullets, that waken truth and deceit, sorrow and pity and joy, that waste precious air in complaints, in lies, in floating traps for power on the dirty air. I believe that all of us have the capacity to speak words that bless and heal, and we all have the capacity to speak words that hurt and curse. All of us have been healed by words uttered to us by others, and certainly all of us have been hurt by words uttered by others. Last week I asked if there was anything that you were ashamed of, and I didn't ask you to raise your hands, but I said I could imagine sitting there and thinking, well, this week, yeah, probably. Same with words that hurt. If I'm asked, did I share any words that hurt this week? If I'm honest, I have to say, yes, indeed I did. The truth is that words have tremendous power. They have the power to start wars. They can bring healing and peace to whole nations and regions of the world. Think about the sinister power of Adolf Hitler's words in Germany. And think about the power of Nelson Mandela's words in South Africa. One set of words helped set off the worst war our world has ever seen. The other won a peace with justice in a country that had been ripped apart by the evil of apartheid. On a more micro level, words can help us as individuals feel on top of the world, and words can push us into a downward cycle of self-loathing and negativity. They can touch like hands, and they can pierce like bullets. So in our lives, one of the great daily ethical challenges is to use our words in a way that heals rather than hurts. Just about every single day we have the opportunity to shape our words in a way that will be good or in a way that will be bad. The exception I can think of are silent retreats, which I kind of like because for once I don't have to be attentive to the words that come out. Using our words to heal does not mean that we have to always be nice or that we can never be confrontational. Trying to use words that heal doesn't mean that we have to be dishonest. And this is where the ethical challenge to use words in a healing way becomes tricky. Sometimes speaking the truth as we see it to another person does, in fact, hurt them. But it may, in the longer run, also be healing. The trick, then, is to express our thoughts honestly, yet with compassion and respect for the other person. In doing so, can allow the words we share, even if they do initially hurt and sting, to possibly be healing in the long run. So, for example, someone who loves an addicted person may need to offer words which embody tough love. And the addict will likely experience these words as hurtful. But if truly listened to and taken to heart, these words may in fact be healing. Similarly, sharing openly and honestly with a person that you've had a disagreement with or about a way the person has hurt you, of course, is probably incredibly painful at first, but again, it can open us to healing, to reconciliation. Not having that honest conversation, on the other hand, can doom a relationship to long-term, even permanent rupture. So my point here is that words don't always neatly fall into the category of healing and hurtful. It's not always that black and white. But sometimes it is. I am very thankful in the past decade or so that there has been a more honest conversation in our society about words that uniformly hurt, and that is words that are expressed in a bullying way. Given the extent to which bullying has gotten into the national limelight, it's probably helpful to go back to what exactly do we mean by bullying? So I looked it up on the computer, the government website on bullying, and it has a pretty good definition. It defines bullying as unwanted, aggressive behavior among school-age children that involves a real or perceived power imbalance. The behavior is repeated or has the potential to be repeated. Both kids who are bullied and who bully others may have serious lasting problems. I think it's a pretty good definition. I would change it to include everybody. I think obviously adults can be bullies just as much as kids. The government definition goes on to define three types of bullying. One is verbal bullying. And this type includes teasing, name-calling, inappropriate sexual comments, taunting, and threatening to cause physical harm. The second type is social or relational bullying, which includes leaving someone out on purpose, telling others not to befriend someone, and spreading rumors about or embarrassing someone in public. The third type is physical bullying, and this means not only physical assault, but also taking or breaking someone's belongings or making mean and rude hand gestures. Clearly, words are an important weapon in the arsenal of a bully. Words are the primary means of attack and intimidation, in fact, in those first two types of bullying I just described. And clearly, words can be every bit as terrifying as actually being hit or attacked by someone. The toll on the self-worth and the soul of the victim of bullying can be immense, and as the choir piece told, sometimes potentially even lethal. We've also heard quite a bit in the last 10 years, I am glad to know that we're talking more about it, that children and youth who identify as or are perceived by others to be lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, questioning, or queer are not surprisingly more likely to be targets of bullying. Homophobia remains a powerful force in our society. That's why this is not surprising. And it doesn't only shape those who may be targeted by bullying, but also all too often it results in adults being silent when they perceive the targets to be LGBTQ. So fighting homophobia is one important way that we can work against bullying. It's important to lift up that bullying is not some infrequent marginal activity in this country. The government reports that between a fifth and one-third of all students have experienced bullying. And if you add up the numbers, that means millions of people have experienced bullying in schools. So taking a strong stand against bullying is a call that I think every single one of us must hear and heed. We need to say in our schools, in our neighborhoods, in our homes, in our workplaces, that we will not tolerate bullying. We need to help the victims of bullying heal their self-worth. We need to help the perpetrators of bullying work through whatever issues and dynamics are manifesting themselves in such destructive behavior so that they can become former bullies. This is incredibly important work. It is life-saving work. And I don't know about you, but with the definition of bullying from the government website, I have to admit that I have been bullied and I have engaged in non-physical bullying. So I want to bring back the focus to the ethical decisions each one of us has to make daily in the way we live our lives about the words that come out of our mouths. In preparation for the sermon, I was thinking about role models for me that helped me do that work. I thought of one this morning, George McGovern, who died in the last day. He was someone I really idolized as a kid, and I even shook his hand. And he was someone who I experienced was able to speak the truth in a way that was peaceful and compassionate. Another role model for me is Abraham Lincoln. We know that Lincoln was not a saint. He struggled. Some of the words that came out of his mouth were incredibly racist. But I also believe that he tried with extraordinary ability and care much of the time to shape his words in ways that were healing rather than hurtful. And even when he had hard truths to share, as he so often did, he was able to do that in a way that cultivated seeds of healing. So, his first inaugural address was a reasonable, respectful appeal to those contemplating secession to stay in the Union. He talked about the undivided national fabric with all of its benefits, its memories, its hopes. He promised no violence or bloodshed unless it was forced upon the national authority. And he clearly articulated the crux of the disagreement, the dispute between the two sides without sugarcoating. One section of our country, he said, believes that slavery is right and ought to be extended, while the other believes it is wrong and ought not to be extended. And he closed his speech with these healing words. We are not enemies, but friends. We must not be enemies. Though passion may have strained, it must not break the bonds of affection. The mystic cords of memory, stretching from every battlefield and patriot grave to every living heart and hearthstone all over this broad land, will yet swell the chorus of the Union when again touched, as surely they will be, by the better angels of our nature. And then 4 years later, in the second inaugural, he spent the bulk of that talking about slavery. As the war was at long last coming to a close, he framed the horrible war as the fruits of God's judgment against both South and North for allowing the evil of slavery to exist on this continent for 250 years. He ended this address with an appeal to all for reconciliation and a peace guided by justice and compassion, not vengeance. Again, he closed with healing words, with malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right as God gives us to see the right. Let us strive to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle and for his widow and his orphan, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and all nations. So in both of these addresses, Lincoln shared hard truths in a compassionate, reasoned, honest way. He did not try to make nice. He did not try to water down the differences between the two sides. He spoke honestly. And then there's the Emancipation Proclamation, and we're now in the midst of celebrating the 150th anniversary of that proclamation. That also contained words that healed. On the one hand, the Emancipation Proclamation wasn't worth the paper it was written on. It freed only the slaves held in bondage in states which were in rebellion. In other words, it freed slaves that the Union Army didn't have the power to free at the moment. But as it turned out, and I believe as Lincoln intended, these apparently meaningless words were the beginning of the end of slavery in the United States. So I'm wondering if we hear a few of these words of Lincoln today, if it brings to mind the political ads that are on the airwaves today. These ads don't seem quite in that same spirit to me. In fact, they seem designed to bring out the worst angels of our nature. And the debates between the candidates for various offices in the United States seem to me more of the same. Simplistic and often just flat-out dishonest attacks dominate these debates. These are hurtful words. These are not healing words. These are not words, in my view, that are going to help our nation turn a corner here. So in observing that we seem to be in a political era dominated by hurtful words, I doubt that I'm saying anything all that revelatory to you. Of course, there were also savage attacks back in Lincoln's day. If you go to the Presidential Library in Springfield, the museum there, there's a whole room showing anti-Lincoln cartoons that make today's attack ads actually look rather tame. But so many of Lincoln's words transcended the petty and the hurtful politics of his day. And that's what I don't see as much of today. And so I am troubled by the state of political discourse in our country. And I don't think we can just blame the politicians and blame the media. I don't even think we can blame the corrupt Supreme Court mandated system of finance, campaign finance reform, or laws that has buried this election process in an avalanche of undocumented, unregulated, unattributed, seemingly endless cash. No doubt the politicians, the media, the Supreme Court are partly responsible for where we are today, but so are we, the public. We seemingly seem to be influenced by negative ads. I don't know why campaigns would spend millions of dollars if they didn't work. We watch TV and we read newspapers and magazines that are all about conflict and disagreement. That's what sells to us, the public, so that's what the media gives us. And we elected the presidents who appointed and the senators who confirmed the Supreme Court justices who ruled out any and all reasonable campaign finance law. So the question then is what we, ordinary citizens living in Northeast Wisconsin, what we can do to help turn the tide. Part of the answer for me is contained in a wonderful book Parker Palmer wrote last year called Healing the Heart of Democracy. And so I want to share five suggestions from that book. The first is to embrace an understanding that we are all in this together. In the language of our seventh Unitarian Universalist principle, we are all related, caught in this inescapable web. Doesn't matter what party we affiliate with. Doesn't matter what state we live in or what nation we live in. Like it or not, we're connected. And Palmer's second suggestion is to develop an appreciation of the value of otherness. It is probably as true today as it ever was that we tend to hang out with people just like us, racially, ethnically, economically, religiously, politically, to name a few categories. And too often this leads us into an us versus them mindset. In the face of this reality, Parker Palmer encourages us to rekindle the ancient tradition of hospitality. This ancient tradition taught us that the stranger, the other, potentially has a lesson or a gift for us. And so when we are hospitable to someone different from us, we invite in that lesson. We invite in that gift. I'm convinced that hospitality takes a lot of practice. I'd even put it as a spiritual practice. So when politicians cut each other off and invade each other's personal space and send video crews to film their opponents' households and air ads that contain mean, probably unfounded attacks, to me, we are very far from the spirit of hospitality. Third, Palmer suggests that we need to cultivate an ability to hold tension and complexity. The truth is we don't actually live in the black and white world of attack ads. Rather than shutting out and ignoring the complexities of the world, we need to embrace them. It is holding the tension of these conflicting perspectives, holding the tension and working through it, that we may be able to actually solve some of our problems. Fourth, we need to develop a sense of personal voice and agency. In spite of the ads and the debates and the polls, politics is not a spectator sport. We need to find and we need to use our voices. We need to use our words to contribute to the solutions to where we are. I love the way locally that our League of Women Voters is speaking about candidates who are choosing not to participate in their debates. They're holding these candidates' feet to the fire, but doing so in a way with integrity, with respect, and in a way that maintains the League's commitment to nonpartisanship. They are a voice that may bring change to our society. Finally, Palmer suggests that we need to develop our capacity to create community. When we come together and work together, then the power of one voice multiplies. A great example is Rosa Parks, sitting on that bus in Montgomery rather than obeying the immoral laws of segregation. And then a community mobilized around her courageous act. And then a nation mobilized and the evil of state-enforced segregation finally began to crumble. So what Palmer is saying is that the salvation of our democracy begins with us, right here. You, me, that's where it begins. In all this, you may say that I'm a dreamer, but I know I'm not the only one. And I know that I cannot help our nation by engaging in bullying and verbal attacks against those who disagree with me. I know I cannot help our nation by being silent in the face of these. Ultimately, for me, there's only one person whose words I can actually control, mine. So today, I renew my commitment to the best of my ability to use my words each day in healing ways. And I invite you to join in this commitment as well.